Hancock & Whitney Bank's economic update call. Hancock Bank & Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice, and opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or any of its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david_lundgren@hancockbank.com, and he will take those questions at the end of the call. Today on the call, I have with me John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren, Investment Director, Luther McDougall, Investment Director, Greg Haluski, Investment Director, and Jeff Tangus, Investment Director. With that, Dave, I'm going to go ahead and pass the call to you.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. John, let's go ahead and we'll start out with talking a little bit about the economy. We've had a really nice run here. I think we've had about four consecutive months of fairly good economic numbers here in the U.S. Consumer confidence is on the rise. The ISM numbers that we received this week were pretty strong. Jobs picture noticeably improving. The four-week average of initial jobless claims reached the second lowest level since 2008. All in all, it's a much more positive tone for the economy than we saw, say, in the summer or fall of last year. What are your thoughts?
Since the market bottomed back in 2009 and the stock market bottomed back in 2009 and the economy began to come out of recession, we've had a fairly consistent, if somewhat choppy, I guess, and slow economic recovery. Last year wasn't good. Last year overall was about 1.7%, somewhere in that range. From the standpoint of annualized GDP growth, we never expected a recession last year, as quite a few in the investment community feared. Risks were elevated, I guess, for a while, and I guess you could say risks are still elevated given what's happening around the world. But the weight of evidence never suggested that we were about to slip back into recession, say, from one quarter to the next. At the end of the year, we still were getting relatively positive signals from the lagging indicators and the coincident indicators and the leading indicators that we probably were, some distance away from a recession occurring. At the same time that this general improvement was going on, a lot of measurements that had been fairly accurate since World War II in indicating the presence of recession or the imminent arrival of recession were still flashing warning signals, and unfortunately that is still the case. It's kind of an odd situation. I think, as you might have read in highlights a while back, we're in one of those situations where models that worked during, let's say, the old normal economy we experienced since World War II up through 2008 don't work in, if I can use PEMCO's, nomenclature, in the new normal economy, because, we're just at a lower level of growth and things that served to warn us about an impending recession before probably just don't work that well anymore. But bottom line, I guess, if you look at everything today, it looks like we're probably not likely to have a recession anytime soon. The numbers are still relatively positive. I got some new information in the mail yesterday from another research operation that's had a fairly good track record, and their numbers are still reading pretty good. And as Dave mentioned, the unemployment our initial jobless claims number has been under 400,000 now for a while, and that's in what economists would call a fairly, fairly decent territory. In terms of growth going forward, though, we've still got a problem. We've got a cyclical recovery. The headwinds we've talked about over time are still there. Nominal GDP, that's not inflation adjusted, was up only a little over 3% in the fourth quarter. And that really needs to be somewhere like 5 or 6% on a fairly steady basis to get some consistent and good inflation-adjusted returns going forward. So it looks like no recession, but at the same time, it looks like, we're still in that relatively slow growth mode. And one thing we always have to be on the lookout for, I guess, are or cognizant of as we read the media reports. As far as the media is concerned, you know, we're either, you know, on a launching pad about to do a moonshot as far as the economy is concerned, which is kind of the way they're leaning after that good employment report. Or if the employment report had been not quite so good, I suppose, they would have thought we were teetering on the edge of the abyss and about to fall into the pit. So the truth is always somewhere in between, or at least most of the time. And now it looks like, you know, the truth still is moderate growth going forward and no recession. Unfortunately, one thing I might mention, we can't model what's going to happen in Europe if Greece implodes, you know, nor can we model what might happen, you know, if things in the Middle East don't work out. But given everything we know at present, minus any unforeseen shocks, we look like we're in pretty good shape.
Well, let's talk about the Middle East if we could. You know, there's been a lot of reports or speculation that Israel will be attacking Iran possibly in the next couple of months. I guess tensions in the Middle East continue to escalate. Is that something that we need to be concerned about? What's your outlook there?
You know, given the weight of evidence that we've seen recently, we probably ought to be fairly concerned about what's happening in the Middle East. You never know when something like this will reach the point of generating an overt clash between, let's say, us and the Israelis and the Iranians. But we all know that a covert war has been going on for some time. You may not know the exact number, but something like 5 or 6 Iranian scientists have been assassinated or blown up in the last few years. Nobody knows who's responsible for that, but the word is that it's either us and or the Israelis. Some other explosions in Iran have damaged their facilities, and I guess as perhaps payback, we are told that the Iranian Secret Service had a plot to blow up the Saudi ambassador in Washington in a Washington restaurant, and they were caught trying to use Mexican drug cartel people, or who they thought were Mexican drug cartel people, and it turned out they were FBI agents. So, you know, something has been going on for some time, and you never know at what point, from the Iranian standpoint, that the sanctions and embargoes that we are placing on them will cause them to do something desperate. And, you know, people often, you know, hark back to Japan prior to World War II when they were invading China and Mongolia and everybody wanted them out. Certainly we did. And we began to embargo shipments of all sorts of resources to Japan, including oil. And apparently the restrictions on oil imports or exports to Japan were the final straw and made Japan take the gamble, you know, that created World War II with us anyway. You know, they wanted to do their own thing in Asia before attacking us, but it didn't work out that way. So, you know, here we've got a situation that seems to be deteriorating fairly rapidly. And this morning in the Wall Street Journal, Brett Stevens has written a column indicating that it probably, something is going to happen in the next 12 months. I mean, that's his guess. I don't know where he's getting his information, but he did indicate that, you know, word was the Iranians may be capable of building a bomb within the next year. They may not be able to deliver it, but anyway, you know how that goes. So it looks like something is building, and unfortunately, you know, we have no idea exactly how that might work out. But something else in the Middle East to be aware of course, that Egypt is in turmoil. Nobody knows whether that's going to be, an Islamist state or not when the turmoil is over, but, you know, they're detaining Americans and tourists are being kidnapped and all that sort of thing. And then you've got Syria, Libya, and Tunisia. So, you know, it's a hot spot. It's probably at least as hot as it was back in the 70s when we lived through, you know, something similar with, you know, various wars and clashes and things of that nature. So here we are again. It's too bad we can't model that, but that is something that we have to be aware of, which would certainly suggest perhaps, a more balanced approach, or at least, you know, not a very aggressive approach to investing.
So let's talk a little bit about the other hotspot. This is, I guess, a financial hotspot, is the Eurozone. Bring us up to date there.
it looks like the LTRO, this latest lending agreement that has been created by the European Central Bank to allow European banks to borrow money at a pretty reduced rate to help liquefy themselves and build up their capital and hopefully to, you know, buy some more Eurozone bonds has been sufficient to take an imminent catastrophe off the table. It looks a lot, though, like they're kicking the can down the road again, because the issue for Greece and Portugal is solvency, and it's not simply a liquidity problem. You can't find research anywhere that doesn't generally point to the eventual default of Greece in some fashion. And the, you know, how it defaults, of course, will have a lot to do with how much disruption it creates in the marketplace. But if it does default, of course, there will be an economic fallout, even if the, you know, financial crisis is not as bad as it might be, if it's not, you know, as it might have been, if it's not controlled in some fashion. But I heard some information this morning from an economics professor who focuses on that part of the world, and he suggested that the money supply in Greece was declining at a 16% annualized rate, that anybody with money has already gotten their money out of the country. There's been a massive capital flight. And so you're left with basically a country with absolutely no money and no way, given all the capital flight that's occurred, to pay back the debt. So, you know, it appears that Greece really is gone. It's just a matter of how they handle the eventual default. And Portugal may be right behind them. Portugal is in almost as bad shape as Greece is. So it's something that's going to be with us for a long time. Again, you can't model it, unfortunately, but probably it's going to keep some pressure on the euro, you know, on the Eurozone, and you know, through the impact on the banks in Europe, it means that Europe is going to go through, obviously they're probably in recession now, but they're going to go through recession and or slow growth for a period of time.
The Greece default, when it occurs, is it something that is so widely expected the market reaction will probably be minimal, or is it difficult to predict at this time, or does it depend on how it unwinds?
I think it depends on how it unwinds. If it's a controlled default with the ECB acting to you know, take Greece, let's say, out of the euro or restructure Greece in some fashion that everybody is comfortable with over a number of years, then, you know, then perhaps the fallout will not be quite as severe. But you know, when you read what's going on and what the various proposals are, it doesn't look like anybody has a firm handle on how it's going to develop. But the general feeling is that they cannot pay the money back, and that the Greek populace cannot stand, you know, the austerity that the Germans would like to impose, for example, you know, to pay the money back. So, complex situation, hard to tell exactly how long it's going to last or what the ultimate outcome will be, but I don't think anybody expects at this point that Greece will remain in the euro or that it won't default in some fashion almost entirely. I don't think anybody believes the Greek bonds are really worth anything at this point.
Okay, great. Greg, you there?
Yeah, I am.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk about the stock market for a minute. January was a really good month. We had very few plus or minus 1% days, so very little volatility. The S&P 500 was up 4.5%. Mid-caps and small caps were up even more. They were up 6.6% each of them, the same return for the month. A few questions. Let's start out with the media. You know, you hear a lot about the January effect. Is that truth or fiction? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, it is quite popular. Let's define it for our listeners. The January effect has to do with stocks being up in January, specifically the smaller capitalization stocks. And if you break those numbers down that you mentioned, if you look at the Dow Jones Index, it was up 3.6%. S&P, as you said, 4.5%. NASDAQ, which is traditionally is small cap type issues, were up 8.1%. So that's a pretty big spread. if you further define it, there's also other components to that January effect, and one of them is, as the first five trading days go, so goes the month. So we were up like 1.8% in the first five trading days, and by that definition, then the next barometer, if you want to call it, the month of January, as it goes, so goes the year. So by definition, we should have a positive 2012. If you look, the Trader's Almanac is something that kind of documents these types of phenomenon, and since 1950, where you've had a year up, year down, based on that first five trading days, you've actually had a 71% accuracy rate. So by that definition, again, we have about a 70% chance of being up for 2012. Now, I like to caution people. Sometimes people draw these conclusions, and it's really an element of causation versus coincidence. And I think, you know, investors need to be kind of cautious about drawing conclusions. There's so many variables that go into it. And, I mean, I'd like to think that there is a January effect, but again, I don't necessarily consider it fiction, but I also don't consider it necessarily a fact that, as John just went through, we've got so, and you and John went through, there's so many different hot spots, so many variables that can impact that. You know, it'd be nice to think we're going to have a positive 2012.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk about earnings. We're reaching the tail end of earnings season, and I don't know that the results have been bad, but they haven't been good. I'd say, you know, fairly mixed, yet stocks still advance. What's your reasoning for that?
Well, if you just look back at the last seven quarters, we've had double-digit gains in earnings growth. And on top of that, the estimates have been far below what we've actually received in terms of reported earnings. Now, that gap has been declining, and I think expectations right now, you're starting to see earnings estimates drift down into around the 9% level. We've had, as I said, double-digit earnings growth, but still 9% is not too bad. And we had such a dismal year last year in the equity markets. I think, you know, to some degree, you've got a number of different factors of probably why the market was up in Germany. Up in January. There's probably, you know, cash sitting on the sidelines still. So you've had, again, we talked on previous calls about the VIX index, which is the volatility index, and that's been drifting down. So I think some of the developments in Europe, assuming that they remain on trend and that, as John pointed out, we have some kind of orderly continued progress in that chronic problem over there, I think that's one of the reasons that stocks advanced. And again, the market is a forward-looking discounting mechanism. I mean, we're focusing right now on the beginning of the year, but the market's already looking out summer in late fall. So, you know, obviously they're seeing some things that, or the market in general is seeing some positives out there, and I think that's why the market was probably up.
Okay, any thoughts on where we're headed from here and why?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still pretty, you know, try not to get too pessimistic. I think John's comment about the media, and I think investors also tend to either get very pessimistic or very optimistic. And, you know, as our outlook is just kind of choppy, muddled growth, I think the positives out there is that you still have a very low interest rate environment. Again, historically, the Fed has never really committed. It's always been very vague in terms of its strategy, but last year it came out and made the comment that rates would remain low until mid-2013, and then even more comments modifying that to possibly 2014. Historically, election years also have been positive, and I think, you know, you don't want to read too much into that, but I think, again, the market is looking for some degree of change, and so maybe there's perhaps an element of optimism built in there. As you pointed out early in the call, we've had, you know, some continued economic improvement, not exactly robust, but you know, improvement all nonetheless. And I think if you look at some of the quarterly estimates on GDP, it looks like there's still increasing potential for growth, not above 3%, but 2.5%, and, you know, given a relatively low inflation environment, relatively low PEs. I think there's some reason to be optimistic looking forward.
All right, sounds good. Thank you, Greg. Luther, you with us?
I'm here.
Great. Good morning.
Morning.
Interesting month for munis. We saw a pretty dramatic drop in yields in the month of January. Can you bring us up to date on the recent market activity?
Sure. Well, during January, we had a number of factors. Kind of, it was the perfect storm, but in the opposite direction for municipals. To kind of set the stage, municipals have historically trailed the Treasury Index, not only in the magnitude of the moves, but also the timing. And from what I've been able to kind of see over the years is that if Treasuries decline this month, municipals will decline next month. I mean, there's anywhere from a 2 to 4 week delay. Throughout the course of last year, we slowly saw investors move back into municipal bonds. And the last year was a good year for munis with the broad index up 10.7%. In January, the index was up another 2.3% for just that month as interest rates continued to fall. Some of that was related to the fact that Treasuries hit some new lows in January. The municipal yield curve, or what we call MMD, Municipal Market Daily, hit its lows since 1981 in the first week of February. And we've been lower back in the 40s, but this is the lowest we've been in 30-plus years. It had to do with the fact that, one, as I mentioned, Treasuries fell. Two, I think we've seen, to a certain extent, a reasonable amount of what we call crossover buying, where taxable institutions, or however you want to put it, say pension plans, et cetera, start buying municipal bonds because the absolute yield on the municipals is higher than what you can get on comparable Treasuries or agencies. So it's kind of a quite default. The flight to quality moving into the municipal market finally after a couple of years of some distress. We've also seen an uptick in revenues at the state level. The third quarter of last year was the seventh straight quarter of increase in tax collections throughout the country. You know, it's not for every state, but for most. And we now actually have revenues above the pre-recession levels for the first time, you know, since back in 2008. And so it's a little bit of everything coming together. Low Treasury yields, crossover buying, flight to quality, better municipal statistics, characteristics, economics, whatever word you like to use. So we hit lows. Now, we've already, and I don't know if this is good or bad, we've already seen a reasonable bounce off of those lows. I think we've probably come very close to hitting that absolute level where buyers overall just can't stomach the low yields. You know, for example, a 5-year right now is at 0.68, and that's it. Of course, much better than you can get on a Treasury, but it's still awfully low to be locking your money up in a municipal for 5 years. But a lot of different factors. And we'll have to see how things go. It all depends on what happens in Treasuries and the flight to quality and overall economic growth and whether it continues to get better or we kind of slow down a little bit. And then it also depends upon what other market participants might have to say, as we saw last year or a year and a half ago when we had one analyst predict massive failures, which we have not seen yet to date. So it was a good year last year. It was a good first month, and we hope to have a continuation of this throughout the rest of the year. But, you know, somewhere around coupon returns are probably what we're looking at. I don't think we can go a whole lot lower because we've reached that absolute level where people just don't want to buy.
All right. Thank you, Luther. Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Central banks around the globe have been very aggressive. I read yesterday in the ISI report that over the last 5 months, there have been 81 policy initiatives announced around the world, including 34 central bank rate cuts. Here in the U.S., the Fed also announced they had no plans to adjust the Fed funds target rate until 2014. We're also hearing rumblings about another round of quantitative easing. What are you expecting from the Fed, and will all of this easy policy result in a big spike in inflation?
Well, the Fed had a busy month in January, really jawboning the market more than anything. There were a couple initiatives where we basically sent a bunch of money over to Europe to help provide some liquidity for their banking system. It wasn't billed as a bailout, but essentially that's what it was. It was us helping them. That we saw some strains, much like over in Europe, much like we saw back in 08 with the Lehman situation in the banking system in Europe. So they helped settle nerves over there, and that took care of that situation, and it seems to be improving overall. But essentially, as you say, the Fed has come out publicly and pushed back their horizon for any sort of rate action, at least as things are, as the economy is interpreted today. I don't think that's necessarily a guarantee, but certainly they came out and said 2014 is when they would expect to maybe take some action on rates, but certainly not before then. Bernanke, who is really calling all the shots right now, everybody else is just sort of along for the ride. His number one concern continues to be deflation because of what's coming out of Europe right now. So he is not at all concerned about inflation in the near term. He talks a lot about it, but the reality is he's much more concerned about deflation. Inflation could be out there, but for the most part, all we have right now is a lot of fear of inflation and no real inflation itself. Ben, late last month, also said that they're considering more asset purchases, and that's generated a lot of talk in the industry. We had a kind of a clash of the titans. Bill Dahl, BlackRock, who runs BlackRock, versus Bill Gross, were basically at odds. Bob Dahl saying no more asset purchases or quantitative easing is necessary. Bill Gross saying there's at least three or four more that will take place. So it's generated a lot of discussion at the highest levels. But at this point, all we know for sure is that the Fed is likely to continue what's called the twist program, in that they're buying as assets mature, they're buying longer and longer maturity assets for their portfolio, driving down longer-term rates because, of course, the short-term rates are already as low as they can get. The Fed lowered its GDP forecast for this year and next, basically looking for something around 2.5% this year and something around 3% next year. That was significantly lower than what they were looking for previously. And they continue to target around a 2% inflation rate. So it really doesn't appear that there's anything that they're changing course in any degree currently. They want to see, I think, some improvement in Europe before they even consider that sort of thing. But the other question people ask is, well, when are they going to start selling some of these securities? And that appears to be way out in 2015 or later before they ever start unloading the, I guess it's $2.6 trillion of Treasury and agency securities that they bought. So, again, it seems to be more of the same, really, but the bias is clearly towards more accommodation, maintaining low rates and nurturing the fledgling recovery that we're seeing in the United States.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. If anybody has any questions, please email me at david_lundgren@hancockbank.com. Okay. If we don't have any questions, I think we'll go ahead and end the call there.
Okay, thanks everyone. We'll post the call on the website as soon as possible. So check www.hancockhorizon.com. Thanks everyone.